Welcome to Anaesthesia on Air, the podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. Good morning, or it is morning here. My name is Helgi Johansson. I'm a consultant anaesthetist at mainly St Mary's in Paddington in London, but also work at the Hammersmith. Also happen to be the Vice President of the Royal College of Anaesthetists. And we're going to talk to you today about sustainability. So with me, I've got Paul Southall, who is a College Council member. He is a consultant anaesthetist in Worcester and has long had a burning interest in sustainability. And Lucy Brooks, who's a specialty trainee in West Yorkshire and rotates, obviously, among the hospitals there. Welcome, both of you.
Good morning.
Nice to be here.
So let's start with Lucy. What got you interested in sustainability? You're now one of our sustainability advisors, and why?
Well, I think I've always had an interest in sustainability. Like many people of my generation, I've grown up knowing about recycling and the things we do at home to improve, well, what I would have then called a carbon footprint, although I come away from that a bit more nowadays. And then I was sort of thinking, well, I spend so much more time at work than I do at home, or rather a lot of my time at work. And how can I cross over here? And I found a job advert for a leadership fellow in climate change and anaesthesia. I was just sort of looking for something different after COVID, a bit of a break from clinical training. And I came across this and thought, I feel like someone's written this job description for me. I showed it to a friend and she said, yeah, I think they have, which they hadn't. So that's how I sort of got involved in the leadership side of it and how I've ended up here.
Well, I'm glad that we almost wrote it for you. Paul, what about you?
I think, I mean, similar to Lucy overall. I think I noticed, as we all do, you know, the dichotomy between what people are used to doing at home and the difference that you make with waste was the first example for me at home. And then what happens when you're at work and the difference in that and the kind of thought process of, well, why aren't we doing something about that? How do we do something about that? And that very quickly, as anybody who's got an interest in it will know, very quickly spirals into looking at all aspects of practice, all aspects of how the hospital works, how the healthcare system works. And when you're in, and I think when you've got an interest in it, it's difficult to back away from it because of how much stuff we've got to do. Mm. And it spirals, but it spirals in a good way. And it's something that you feel like you're making a difference with.
Yeah, and for me, I remember a single point which probably the penny dropped. I was looking through some old photos of mine and a photo of my grandmother in Iceland popped up. Well, when I say popped up, it was an actual physical photo. Mm-hmm. So I looked at where she was, which was Jökulsárlón, which is the lagoon just by Vatnajökull, the biggest glacier in Iceland. I won't ask you to pronounce either of those. And when my grandmother was there, circa 1965, the lagoon was really quite small. Then I found another photo in 1988 of me taking my friends there, and it was significantly bigger. And then another photo of me a couple of years ago, and this lagoon has turned into a lake full of icebergs, still an absolutely amazing place to go. But the glacier has just gone back so far. And it was a really visual reminder of what's going on and that actually we need to do something about it. So what have we done about it? So we have at the college an environmental advisory group, of which you are two of the members. And let's start with the obvious. So NHS England, Wales, Scotland, etc., the NHS, shall we say, put a lot of emphasis on anaesthetic gases being a contributor to global warming, and particularly desflurane. And we've now had desflurane decommissioned. What do you think about that, Paul?
I think in principle it was a big achievement in and of itself, just because it was the first time that something like that had happened, a product had been taken out of use solely for perceived environmental impact. And I think you can't underestimate the importance of doing that with the other work that we do. the science changes quite a lot, and you know, the anaesthetic vapors probably aren't going to be as much in the limelight as they have been recently going forward. But I don't think that changes the scope of the achievement that we did and that we did within our specialty, and we shouldn't underestimate that, and we should congratulate ourselves for that, because that wasn't just something that was done of those with an interest. It was the whole anaesthetic community that did it and proved that we can change stuff when we want to on the basis of environmental concerns. And we shouldn't forget that with the other stuff going forward, because the task's Herculean to do it all. But we've done one bit of it and we can do all the rest of it. And I think it demonstrated that point really, really well.
I thought it was really interesting. And it was actually, Lucy, really interesting that it was your generation that led this. Mm-hmm. And the use of desflurane went down way before we or the NHS did anything about it.
Yes, I think this is sort of what we're talking about, pushing at open doors. That, as Paul has said, the task of improving sustainability in the healthcare system is absolutely Herculean. And to start by pushing at an open door somewhere where change was already happening made it possible, I think, to really make change happen quickly. I think we have to look at the lessons we've learned from that. And it's really exciting thinking about leadership and change management and how we can apply that going forward. I certainly have been working with some novice anaesthetists recently who have never seen desflurane. They've never used it. And people just sort of, they don't really get what the big deal is all about. And I think that's really exciting. It's not just that we've changed something. We've also changed the culture so quickly and so rapidly, which obviously is necessary given the climate and ecological crisis we're facing. Fast change is going to be the thing that makes the difference. Mm.
Clearly, we'll still examine desflurane in the primary for the next 50
years. Oh, well, yeah,
years,
absolutely.
But yeah, and your listeners may have heard there's been a little bit of a doubt in all our voices about quite how much contribution the anaesthetic gases make overall to climate change. And that's essentially the argument about global warming potential, and which they all of them definitely do have. However, most of them don't spend very long in the atmosphere, and so therefore probably actually only contribute a tiny amount. Although desflurane does last in the atmosphere for about 15 years, if I remember correctly. That might be in the primary too, who knows. Actually, there was a climate change question in the primary recently, which I thought was progress, and we'll come on to a bit about education later. So other gases, the other one, the blue gas, nitrous oxide. I think that's something really exciting where we really can make a big difference. Lucy, do you want to tell us a little bit about what we're doing there?
So you may have seen projects called the Nitrous Oxide Project. And what's been going on is, initially this started in Scotland, which feels quite special considering where we are today in Glasgow. But a team in Scotland were looking at how much of nitrous oxide gas is wasted and came up with this theory that the clinical usage didn't really fit with how much money was being spent on the nitrous oxide gas. They interrogated this and found huge amounts of wastage in the system, essentially leaking from pipes, from challenges in manifold management, and found that in some cases up to 100% of nitrous oxide that was being bought and piped into through manifolds was actually never reaching a patient, which is quite shocking in itself, just simply from waste of money. Mm. The other arm of this is that we know that nitrous oxide is a significant greenhouse gas. It hangs around in the atmosphere for over 100 years, and so it does significantly contribute to global warming. It's also an ozone depleter, so we don't want to be creating any more holes in the ozone if we can help it. So the idea that we're wasting all this money and having this harm on the environment is really quite shocking. And so work's been going on up and down the UK looking at decommissioning manifolds and trying to stem the leak. And there are some places now where they're even looking at completely eliminating their piped nitrous oxide completely supply and moving simply to cylinders where necessary. So it's going to be a change to practice in some places. Although, again, I'd say similar to the desflurane, from a trainee perspective, a lot of people have never used nitrous oxide. It's just not part of our normal clinical practice at the moment.
Mm. So, Paul, I've been very impressed so far by how good you are at project management and getting things through. And you've managed to do this locally at your place, haven't you?
Yeah, and I think there's quite a few places now that have started off locally to do it. And I think it's a good project, an exciting project from our perspective in the Environmental Advisors Group and the college as a whole, because it can demonstrate how we can take good practice locally and act as a college in a way that we might not necessarily have acted before, and kind of coordinate and lead some guidance, which we're doing at the moment, and hopefully will be out soon, on what we do with nitrous oxide manifolds in this case. And I think that's the most exciting part about this work, is that we can change slightly what the college has done before and modify it and take a lead on issues that it might not necessarily have taken a lead on before, because they weren't at the forefront of everybody's mind like they are now. And a lot of that is born from local changes. So when we talk about how people get involved in sustainability and what they do and what the important things are, all of this work starts somewhere and starts up with small little projects that you can then build on and kind of exacerbate good practice. And that's what a lot of what I would like us to do to be about would be about upscaling that and make sure that it's robust and has got a good evidence base to it, and that we can act to coordinate that naturally and cut through some of the treacle that inevitably comes with a lot of sustainability work, because it can get quite slow going, as we will all know, and anybody who's had any interest in it will know.
Absolutely. And it was quite interesting. I went to a meeting about new hospital builds, and quite a lot of this knowledge takes a long time to filter through, especially to other professions. And so the engineers, when I told them that we don't really want nitrous oxide pipes, the engineers jumped for joy. So we're probably knocking at an open door for most hospitals, and they think that it's us that want it. Certainly I've seen in clinical practice in my hospital that nitrous oxide is almost no one uses it. There's still the odd one or two people, and particularly for pediatric inhalational inductions. But then other pediatric anaesthetists do inhalational inductions perfectly well without it. So you can argue that actually for the amount of harm that it does to the climate, then maybe we should think about using alternatives and change our practice.
Yeah, there was two things probably worth just quickly reiterating with that. I think one is that there's much less, well, virtually no ambiguity with the perceived impact of nitrous oxide, like there is with the vapors at the minute, where we're a little bit uncertain. There's no uncertainty with nitrous oxide. And I think on the back of what you've just said about kind of pediatric anaesthesia and obstetric anaesthesia, what we're working on is something that's going to be unifying, so that it has all those organizations represented, so that there's no, again, no ambiguity about what we're trying to do and what we're trying to say, so that people can be reassured by what we say, that we've thought about it and it is the right thing to do.
And that brings us to the labor ward. I was toying with the idea of not mentioning this at all, because that gets quite difficult, but I'm going to. How are we going to manage the way nitrous oxide is used on the labor ward? Lucy?
Well, I think it's, first of all, we need to distinguish between nitrous oxide for anaesthetic use and Entonox used in labour. And I think for me, the most important thing when we're thinking about this is to remember that patients are at the centre of it. And if we were going to move away from using Entonox entirely, we'd have to have a viable alternative, something that is safe for patients to use, that the midwives are happy to use without anaesthetic support, for example. And I'm sure we can all think of a whole variety of problems of saying we can't use Entonox anymore. I also don't think it's, as anaesthetists, our place to say that. We're a vast many cases in labour ward that we don't get any involvement in whatsoever. So I think we really need to look at a multidisciplinary approach to this. So including our obstetric colleagues, our midwifery colleagues, and thinking about, is there a viable alternative long-term in the future? I think at the moment that's quite hard to see. So I think rather than thinking about saying we're going to scrap Entonox use completely, we need to interrogate our pipework systems again and think, are we leaking? Are we wasting things? How can we minimise our wastage? How can we keep our staff safe with appropriate scavenging and making sure we don't have high levels of nitrous oxide in our labour rooms, exposing our staff day in, day out to this? And also, what do we do about that gas that we then scavenge? We know that there is some technology where we can crack that nitrous oxide down into non-harmful substances which don't have a big impact on the environment. And it will be an investment, but I think it's something that we're going to have to look at, thinking about the fact that we don't really have significant viable alternatives for every labour and every labouring person that comes into the hospital.
And I think that that nitrous cracking technology is probably the way forward. I think also something that we maybe don't do enough of is just an awareness campaign, particularly for midwives. And you'll see midwives talking about, have some gas and air. This is a environmentally harmful gas, so we should use it definitely when we need it, but not waste it.
Yeah, I think there's something there about patient education. So I know about these things. And when I had my baby, I was very keen not to use nitrous oxide. And I know that you can say these things in advance and you actually get there and you're in labour and you change your mind. And I think that's fine. Yeah. And I wouldn't judge anybody for using nitrous oxide. But for me, I felt very, very strongly about not wanting to use a gas that was going to be in the atmosphere for longer than my child walks on the planet. And I think that really comes into the idea of consent. And what are we telling our patients about this? I think a lot of the sustainability work and decisions and the impact on clinical practice, we've taken quite a paternalistic view. We as the doctors or managers or sustainability managers have said, these are things that are harmful and these things are harmful, but we're going to do them anyway because we don't have an alternative. There's almost always an alternative. And I wonder at what point we need to start talking about sustainability and climate impacts, environmental impacts of treatments when we're talking to our patients, because for some people it really matters.
I think the Entonox issue flags up something that I feel very strongly about. I think I can speak for all of us when I say that we all feel strongly about it. And it's worth reiterating for people who are inherently a little bit sceptical about the sustainability changes that we're thinking. And I think that is worth reiterating that, you know, front and centre, we can't be making anything worse by doing it. And I think that feeds in quite nicely with Entonox, in that, you know, I get feedback quite a lot from people who assume that Entonox is going to be next. We're going to do nitrous oxide and then we're going to do Entonox. And I think, as Lucy said quite well, you know, that only works if there's something that is going to be at least as good or better before we do it. And that's the founding point for any sustainability change that you look at, is this has to be at least as good or it has to be better, or move on to something else until there is something for that that is at least as good or better. So I wouldn't want people to think this. We are walking around with clipboards trying to think how we can make people's jobs more difficult and patients' experiences worse, because that's not what it's about. And with Entonox, the apparent solution is going to be very much more what can we do after we've used it rather than taking it away for people to use. And I think it's worth reiterating that. Mm.
I'm going to move us on from the gases now, and I think it's definitely shown us something, and shown every listener that something that we can do practically, very low hanging fruit if we're going to use management speak. And I hate myself already for having done that. Some other low hanging fruit, gowns, disposables, PPE. Throw away this, throw away that. One of the real irritations I have in my job, and this sounds very minor, obviously, is at the end of my case, we have a blue slide sheet, which is plastic, essentially, and they take that off and they use another plastic sheet to slide the patient over on the bed, rather than just roll the patient to take the original one off, or just, in fact, use a cloth thing like we used to in the olden days. So how can we be a bit more sensible about what we do?
Well, we need to be thinking about what we're using, don't we? We need to be taking some responsibility every single day. What are we opening? And what are we using that gets thrown away? I've done some work in Yorkshire looking at the pre-made packs for things like arterial line and central line insertion. And looking at a sort of a region-wide audit, we had 10 hospitals involved. And we found that the vast majority of packs, in fact, every single pack had something thrown away that never touched a patient. The average number of items thrown away was 3 and a bit. I mean, you don't have a bit of a syringe, but, you know, you take my point that actually in practice, we're opening things that don't touch a patient and go straight in the bin clean, which I think is, I mean, just horrendous, isn't it? And how can we look at ways of mitigating that risk? And obviously, that specific example is quite complicated because different people use different parts of the packs. But actually, we know if 80% of people aren't using this one item, we can probably get rid of it and the other 20% will just have to change their practice slightly, for example. Obviously, from a change management perspective, that's challenging. So I think the first thing is acknowledging that this waste exists and being mindful of the things that we open and what we do and don't need in theatres. And thinking about when we do and don't need to wear gloves, for example, particularly in relation to PPE. And I know the Intensive Care Society have been following the Royal College of Nurses with the Gloves Off campaign, which I think is brilliant. You know, clean hands are cleaner than non-sterile gloves that have been sat on the wall for a few weeks. So we should be, that's not just protecting us, it's also protecting our patients and the planet, so patients of the future. So my sort of main thing about this is just being mindful.
I've been in a campaign, shall we say, at work, particularly on my day surgery list, for the recovery nurses who are receiving the patient, or the nurses in theatre, when they're taking the stirrups off, which are not dirty, they're not soiled with anything, and they always put gloves on to do it. And it just seems crazy to me. And I think I had a bit of a win recently. When I entered recovery, one of the recovery nurses really subtly just took her gloves off because she saw me. So I think maybe I'm getting somewhere. What do you think, Paul?
I'd reiterate what Lucy says. I think that there's a lot of, you know, sustainability is sexy at the minute, and there's a lot of people that are interested in it, and there's a lot of companies that are interested in it, some for holistic reasons, some for good reasons, some for slightly less good reasons. And for things like packs, you know, that there are lots of potential options on the horizon now about swapping out the plastics for things like, you know, sugarcane derivatives, things like that, which are better. But as Lucy says, you know, it's all very well and good doing that, but if you're swapping out an item that you don't use for an item that you still don't use but it's made of a different material, just don't use it. So before you do any of this stuff, you've got to look at what don't we need. And there's a lot of stuff that we probably don't need as often as we might think we do. And there does need to be a bit of a shift, which is difficult to do, and it has to happen on an individual basis, but there has to be a bit of a shift around the, well, I'd like that to be in there just in case, because the just in case is a rare and we probably don't need it as routine with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and the concept of the just in case is probably damaging in itself in the amount of waste that it produces. I'm going to say one word to you, Paul: spinals.
Yeah, and I think this is something that as we've looked at as a quite a lot for quite a long time as an environmental advisory group around, do we need to use gowns routinely in spinals? We're a bit of an outlier in this country for still doing it compared to some other developed countries. It's a tricky one because it's a big change in practice and it does polarise people. It tends to be people who are very keen to adopt it and go ahead with that. There are people that are very resistant to it. And it's one of those things where we wanted to try and tackle that first because it seemed like a low-hanging fruit. To use, I also hate myself now for using that term.
But join it is the club.
Yeah, it is a little bit more complicated than that. And we've had to learn, I think, that we've got to be cautious but not over cautious when we give guidance on stuff like that. My personal practice now is I hardly ever use a gown for it. I still prep like you would do normally. There's a decent amount of evidence for using a mask for spinals. There's not a huge amount for using a gown. There's not a huge amount for not using one either, which makes it tricky when it comes to us giving guidance on it. So I know that there's been, you know, a few people that I've spoken to who are very keen for the Royal College to tackle that as one of our things that we look at. We are still doing it, and we've just got to be careful about how we word what we might say on that, just to encompass the full breadth of opinion of people who are doing it day to day. But it is something that is, I'd encourage individuals to think about what they wanted to do in their practice or not.
Mm. And I think it's interesting because it's so difficult to roll back guidelines that have been brought in, particularly when there's not necessarily that good evidence for it, but there's that just in case that one in a million individual they might get harmed, and it's a difficult argument to counter. I think we can counter it, and on a personal level, I don't scrub up with a gown for a spinal. I use a mask because there is some evidence for it. There's no evidence for the gown. In fact, there's probably evidence that the gown makes no difference. And my argument is that we're putting an extra few minutes onto each and every operation, and nationally that makes a big difference. And if you're doing an urgent cesarean section and you get the baby out 1 to 2 or 3 minutes earlier, then actually that tiny improvement in that baby's condition probably outweighs the tiny, tiny, tiny chance that there might be an infection and you might get sued for it.
I also think we're talking about harm to who, right? Mm. So we talk about the potential risk of infection for the individual patient in front of us. And there, I quite agree with you about the time for that individual baby and the improvement in outcomes. But that's quite a narrow view. And actually, when we're talking about sustainability and climate and environmental breakdown, we need to be talking about not just the patient in front of us. You know, our first do no harm doctrine is harm to who? And I think that actually, if you look globally, we know that environment and climate breakdown is bad for health. In fact, the World Health Organization have said that climate change is the biggest health threat facing all of humanity. And so I think that we need to step away from, well, this is just bad for one person in front of me, and think, well, this is bad for all people across the whole world. And even though people think, oh, well, those people are far away, it doesn't impact me, climate change isn't impacting us here. Well, it is actually. We know that in the UK, hospital admissions go up and mortality rates go up during heat waves. We know there's an increased risk of miscarriage during heat waves. We know there's association between heat waves and psychiatric illness. So actually, yes, the patient in front of you is important, but I really think we need to expand our view of who we're thinking about when we're talking about harm.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So just to expand that a little bit, I'm very much in on the spinal and not wasting PPE when we don't need it. Definitely use it when you do need it, but not when you don't. But expanding on that a bit, what kind of practical things can our listeners do day to day just around the theatre, operating theatre, or the pre-assessment clinic, or you know, wherever else you're working, intensive care unit, etc.
There's probably lots of stuff, is the short answer. There's also probably lots of stuff that we haven't yet thought of that we can, if we properly look at it, there's probably lots of little pinch points where we can make a difference. Just from a practical, you know, when we're delivering anaesthetic, only open what you need. It's easy to say, but we're creatures of habit. You go through training, you get taught how to do a procedure, how to insert an IGL, you get taught how to do a tube, you get taught how to do a central line. And there's a lot of that that maybe we don't need to open quite as much stuff as we thought we do. Mm. And again, it's the recurring mantra of anything to do with sustainability. If you don't need to use it, don't use it. And that's the easiest solution to it. I would say try to involve everybody in the theatre setting on the stuff that you're involved with, because it's very easy for us to get siloed into anaesthesia. Surgery makes an exponentially bigger impact on this stuff than we do. Most surgeons that I've found are actually quite amenable to approaching this and looking at it. So I think even just starting off with the conversations, if you're very early in the journey, you're doing sustainability stuff, just chatting to people and seeing whether there's other stuff that we can influence via our role within theatres. And don't use nitrous oxide, or use it via a cylinder if you can.
Lucy, what are your top tips?
I think that we need to make every contact with our patients count. We know that surgery can be a turning point for patients in terms of lifestyle change. And we also know the best way of reducing the health impact and the climate impact of healthcare is to not have to provide it in the first place. So things like perioperative medicine and perioperative management of patients' comorbidities, so smoking cessation advice. And when we speak to our patients and they tell us preoperatively how much wine they're drinking every week, you know, saying to them, have you thought about cutting down? And it doesn't have to be, you know, high-risk periop clinics. This is our day-to-day interactions with our patients. How can we promote good health? How can we get our patients to take control over their own healthcare and their own lifestyles? And I think really that's something that all of us can do at any stage of training, wherever you're working. And it's something that can really make a big impact on the bottom line of all of this work.
Yeah, and I would reiterate a bit more, just to give people an idea of the scope. We're in a good position with our profession. We're used to thinking about this much more than other professions are at the minute, much more than other specialties within medicine are. And when you start to get an interest in it and you look beyond theatre and you look at the hospital and healthcare in general, that's when you can start to make the big differences. To put it into perspective, our trust is a DGH, effectively, three sites, and our carbon impact of the operation of the trust is greater than the country of the Gambia. Mm. And, you know, there were more than 200 trusts in the UK. So you can see how this spirals out, and we are in a good place to get involved with that. We got told that, you know, it's greater than the Gambia or the equivalent to a flight from the UK to Jupiter. And it's nuts, this is big stuff. Big stuff. And yes, the direct anaesthetic remit in terms of what we can change day to day seems very small in that. But our impact, again, to go back to what we started talking about right at the beginning, you know, we change a practice like desflurane. It proves that it can be done. And from a trust perspective and a healthcare perspective, that's quite powerful to be able to say, well, we can do this, so why can't we look at the energy? Why can't we look at transport? Why can't we look at all this stuff? And we're in a good place to start those conversations.
Mm. And Lucy, I think what you said about perioperative medicine is absolutely correct. The patient is at a unique point where we can influence their health for a long time. Because they have an operation coming up that they're quite frightened about. And so they may actually be a bit more motivated to do something towards it. And improving that patient's health is so important. And this comes back to the thing that sustainable medicine is actually generally more efficient and more economical medicine as well. You're reducing waste, you're reducing the number of visits the patient makes to the hospital, and you're improving the patient's health and smoothing out the patient's journey through the hospital.
Absolutely. I think there's, in some circles, a false dichotomy drawn with sustainable care versus good quality care. And actually, sustainability has been seen and shown to be a domain of quality healthcare. The Royal College of Physicians have got that in their little jigsaw of what does good quality care look like. Sustainability is part of the puzzle. And I think that, exactly as you say, sustainable care and good quality care can go hand in hand. And what I would really encourage people to do is, when you're looking at quality improvement in your line of work, when you're thinking about what changes you need to make it to your service, is to embed sustainability in that, thinking about what's the environmental costs and values in this change, as well as the financial impact, and also thinking about the social impact. What impact does this have on our staff? What does it have on the service as a whole and the culture here? And I think it's really exciting. I think it's really exciting to think about how we can change the face of the way we practice clinical medicine to be better for not just the people in this country and our future generations, but for the future generations across the world. It's brilliant.
Mm. And I think that there's something here that we as the college have a unique role in as well. Mm. In particularly kind of on the guidelines front and on our interaction with other institutions. And I'm thinking, for instance, CQC and the inspections done by the CQC, which for the last probably 10 years or however long they've been in existence, have been about increasing the amount of single-use items because of just-in-case infection control and essentially making the healthcare kind of less sustainable from that point of view. And I think we can do something here where the CQC actually looks at you and says, hang on, you're not supposed to be using gloves at this point. And they can enforce some of the things that we're trying to do. And I think we as the college need to have a really good think whenever we bring guidelines out, whether these guidelines are causing environmental harm or unnecessary waste.
Yeah, I would agree. And I would just want to reassure and reiterate to everybody that, you know, we're not here to sit on a committee that doesn't do anything. You know, we're here to make change. We're not going to sit around and not do anything. We are going to be slightly altering the way that the college has operated in this sphere before. It takes a bit of time to do it. But we want to do it, and we want to do it for all the reasons that have been mentioned. And we want it to become the new normal, better way of doing things, and we can do that. We're not going to do it overnight, but we can do it. And I think the college has got a pivotal role in that, that we're properly now realizing the full potential of, I think, and we want to drive all that as best we can.
Yeah, absolutely. Lucy, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that as the college, we've got a role in leadership in this space. I think that it's a really exciting opportunity for us as environmental advisors to sort of force the point home, actually, saying, well, is sustainability on every agenda? And I've been talking with people at the college about, you know, banking and how can we improve the carbon footprint or the environmental impact of the college itself as well, and lead by example. It's not just about how we run our clinical practice, it's also about how we run all of our services. And I think that as the college, there is appetite to make a change and to be the change that we want our members to follow.
Yes, and I asked an awkward question in a meeting the other day about our pension funds within the college, which was... I think it made the pension company feel uncomfortable, which was entirely why I asked it, and designed for that purpose. And I think if every college, every employer asks that question of the people that provide their pension, then the pension funds will start to divest from fossil fuel investment.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know the college has already divested from fossil fuels in terms of our money. And we need to be seeing more people do that, you know, more colleges do that, more organisations do that. And I think for there being people like us in the room to ask those difficult questions is really important. And I think that we have a really unique opportunity to make some change here.
Yeah. So I'm going to start winding this up now, and it's been a really fun chat, and I think we've covered some really important topics and some topics that our listeners can do an awful lot about as well. I think any final tips? One sentence, Paul?
I would say fundamentally, sustainability is 99% change management, 1% the science behind it. Most people know that we should do it. It's just how you go about doing it. It's hard, but it's doable, and we have to do it all together. We've already started doing that, and we can carry on doing it and keep on leading from the front with it.
Absolutely. Following on from that, my take home for everybody is just to get involved, to embed sustainability into all your work, into all your change management and quality improvement, and just crack on with it.
And I'm going to add mine to that, which is make it less complicated, make your anesthesia less complicated, and don't use stuff that you don't need to use. So I think it's time to wrap it up. Thank you very much, Lucy Brooks and Paul Southall, and I'm Helgi Johansson. And please tune in, click like, subscribe to the podcast, and we'll see you all soon.
The RCOA warmly welcomes members from across the globe. So if you are based outside of the UK, we invite you to discover the array of benefits available to you as an RCOA international affiliate. To learn more about joining and to explore the benefits of membership, visit rcoa.ac.uk/international-affiliate or click on the link in the show notes.